Hello, today's show includes discussion of student suicide and mental health. If you need support, contact the Samaritans on 116 123 or visit samaritans.org. It's The Wonky Show. A brutal funding settlement from DfE will assess the damage, a damning review of student suicides calling for better support, and new research on the reality of cold spots. It's all coming up.
Where we're all trying to get to grips with is that there's major, you know, societal change happening for a variety of different reasons. And what is, you know, the cause of some of these challenges, but also what are the expectations on institutions?
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to get across the week's news, as usual, three excellent guests. In Hendon, Sian Waring is Vice Chancellor at Middlesex University. Sian, your highlight of the week, please.
Morning, Jim. Congratulations to all the universities at Wednesday night's What Uni Awards, which are voted on by students, and in the midst of some challenging HE times, it was really lovely to see all the great HE stuff going on.
What did you win, Sian? What did you win at Middlesex?
We got a gold for facilities and we came silver for University of the Year.
Very good. Full list of winners in the show notes. In Bickley, Richard Brubner is Executive Chair at the UPP Foundation. Richard, your highlight of the week, please.
Jim, so a dirty secret for lots of football fans, which they don't like talking about, is actually there's lots of people that support two teams. And so last night, as a sort of Manchester United supporting Southend United fan, I had the very difficult evening of watching two screens where United were playing, obviously, against Spurs in the Europa League final, and Southend were playing against Forest Green Rovers in the National League playoff semi-final. And as you know, founder of this parish will be very chirpy, Mark Leach, because obviously Spurs won the Europa League final 1-0, but Southend actually won on penalties. So my evening ended up very, very happy as Southend were all going to Wembley on the 1st of June.
None of that will be in the show notes. And in Coleshill this week, Debbie McVitie is editor at Wonky. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Richard saved me from giving a hat tip to the Europa League. So, you know, I'll just say all of my children are very grumpy this morning after a very late night last night. But I think my big highlight of the week actually was I got the opportunity to go up to the annual UCAS admissions conference on Monday and host a conversation with two amazing women, Jo Saxton, Chief Executive UCAS, and Viv Stern, Chief Executive Universities UK. And it was one of those kind of very special moments when you realise just how much the sector's changed. You've got three women on stage talking about leadership and change and challenge. And it felt like a very special time, despite the massive cold that I have been harbouring all week.
And a fantastic, really interesting blog from UCAS actually on the site this week. We'll put that in the show notes. So yes, we start this week with funding. DfE's annual letter to OFS emerged this week. Debbie, how deep is the love?
I don't think it's about the love. I think, you know, I guess we'll get on to talking about that. Yeah, so the sector was obviously not super happy to receive. So a letter issued from the desk of the Secretary of State, Bridget Phillipson, to the Office for Students, confirming the funding for the strategic priorities grant for the coming year, 2025-26. The headlines are the recurrent funding pot is down 108 million on last year, so that's down to 1.35 billion. And capital funding has also been reduced to just 84 million, which is quite a significant cut from the last 3 years. One, I think, thing to take from this is that the government, I mean, obviously the government is dealing with a context in which everyone's trying to figure out how to make cuts. What I think the sector needs to take from this is about the reprioritising of funding to things that the government considers strategically important. So the OFS has been asked to look at moving high-cost subject funding away from some high-cost subjects, including media studies, journalism, publishing, information services course, and towards nursing, midwifery, allied health, the sort of public sector health jobs, courses, I mean. The student premium funding, which is distributed to institutions in relation to the number of less advantaged students that they recruit, will be not allocated to franchise provision unless the delivery partner is an institution that's in the category of, you know, unless it's got less, the delivering institution itself has an access and participation plan. And lots of things that you would think the government would consider to be important, but has clearly decided that there just isn't really space for, such as degree apprenticeship development and level 4 and 5 skills top-up funding, the funding's been moved away from. So I think there's a question mark about whether this constitutes part of the hard rain that's been threatened, or whether this is just, you know, trimming the sails to manage the weather. And I guess that's what we'll talk about.
Sean, I guess that, you know, it's been many years now, really, since this particular pot of funding did what it was originally supposed to do, which was top up the original 9K fee for all sorts of things, you know, for London or for disadvantage or for higher costs. So, you know, to some extent, it's, you know, this overall pot is so small these days, it doesn't make much difference, does it?
Well, I guess it's more the optics, Jim, which is sort of following up on Debbie's points. There's clearly not a deep well of public money to shore up the sector. And we know there's lots of other areas, public sector areas, that make a huge contribution to our collective lives. And they're also struggling. So I don't think this is a surprise. It would have been a shock the other way around, frankly. So I think we're expecting financial stringency. I guess my question is there any underlying plan to the piecemeal announcements and changes? Because certainly the government's giving a very little with one hand and then taking away quite a lot more with the other, with an overall net negative financial impact. So I guess what I'm wondering is it a new model of financing introduced by stealth, you know, the shifting of priorities and focus, or probably worse, it's not a model, it's disconnected events without a joined up plan. But I think the reality for us is the same really either way, which is to review and reinvent ourselves so we can continue to offer the opportunities that education brings to individuals and societies in straitened times. And I there's no getting away from that.
Debbie, this thing about, they've taken the extra money that went into the costs for running media studies, journalism, and so on. And they're saying that they're going to redistribute that to, you know, basically lab-based stuff. That strikes me as being, you know, a kind of a lever they're attempting to pull to influence provision. But that lever is no way big enough, is it, to kind of influence actual provision that actual institutions then put on?
I think I've got to start by making a really wonky point, which is that the Secretary of State is asking OFS to find a way to reprofile the funding. So she is not saying you must do this. She is saying this is my directive, and there's a sort of OFS has to then kind of think about the implications and how to manage that. So it is for OFS to kind of work out that the kind of exact nature of that reprofiling. I think one of the things that probably doesn't happen very much because of this annual allocation is an actual impact assessment of what happens. I mean, I remember Gavin Williamson standing up in Parliament and saying, we're making cuts to media studies. And, you know, and it's not, you know, obviously that was very much kind of, obviously that was very much about kind of sending a signal. But I think actually fundamentally that was about, you know, dealing with a kind of challenging fiscal environment. And it's just that government wanted to make more hay from that than this one. What I think would be interesting to look at is whether, you know, what degree of difference it makes. I imagine that in some institutions, particularly where there is specialist provision, some of those institutions may be shored up by the funding strand that is dedicated to world leading specialist provision. But I doubt that, you know, I doubt very much that you get a sort of, you know, nice balance there. It may become harder to deliver some of those courses, and the government sort of knows that at a high level and is willing to take the hit on that. I suppose the question then really is whether you also get more of the nursing and the midwifery and the allied health and the STEM, because actually the amount that's going in from that is not really enough to change the balance of risk in the institutional calculation of what's on offer. And of course there's other factors in play here as well, which is about student demand and industry relationships and all the other things that might make it kind of sensible to put on a course. So I don't think that what Bridget Phillipson is doing here, or the DfE, is, you know, enormously reprofiling subject provision, but there is I think quite a strong signal here that it's sort of saying, how do we set priorities? And I think the most interesting thing actually about the letter, I mean, obviously it's very challenging for the sector to sort of be dealing with cuts of this nature and to be preparing for the year ahead, but actually the next thing is going to be that the strategic priorities gets reviewed, so that from 2026-27 there'll be much more thinking around, well, what are the government's strategic priorities? That'll be around the industrial strategy, around the kind of economic growth targets, and how can the SPG support that? And that, you know, that review will be coming together in the months ahead.
Yes, interesting. Now, Richard, this premium funding, you know, originally it was kind of designed as a corollary to the pupil premium. You know, the idea is it helps with the costs of students most at risk of dropping out. Now, the cut is to franchised provision. And, you know, you can see a case for this, can't you? Because the vast majority of students, you know, that were, you know, counting to draw down this funding are in private providers that are making huge profits. Why would you subsidise that?
Good point. And obviously, franchise provision has been a key theme on the Wonky, both podcasts and obviously on your pages. I think you make a good point in the piece that you wrote I think it was this week, Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, around is it targeted enough on the right type of provision in terms of these cuts. I'd actually, you know, a point that I wanted to make was link it to the sort of the capital funding, if you forgive me, and what the link is to that. So you've seen that there's this, you know, there was this three-year program about 450 million, and then they've now announced there's going to be an 84 million program for capital funding next year. Now, I'm going to give another sporting comparison. Okay, so I was playing cricket on Saturday at Upminster Cricket Club for Harold Wood Twos, and we couldn't use the pavilion because the pavilion at Upminster is currently being redeveloped, so it's being slightly extended and they're gutting out the middle. Now, they are spending north of £500,000 to redevelop their pavilion, which is a smallish pavilion in a park in the UK, right? Now, there's £84 million going to capital funding for all universities via competitive funding, as well as some of it going to JISC. And you sort of go, well, I can understand the point of a £450 million fund over 3 years, which most universities will probably benefit from for something, some kit at their institution. It won't be transformational, but it will make improvement. Now, what is the point, personally, of an 83 million quid or 84 million quid capital fund that isn't going to touch the sides when the opportunity cost of actually that money going towards sort of students that are struggling with cost of living or disadvantaged students in some way could actually make some difference to people's lives? So I think the priorities there are a little odd, but you know, in terms of, you know, where they are making the cuts, I think overall targeting franchise provision seems like the right idea, but can they be a bit more targeting at the right and the wrong provision, if that makes sense.
But Debbie, this speaks to a wider point, doesn't it? Which is, if this is the strategic priorities letter, the overall amount of money going in now from DfE is just not enough to deliver actual strategic priorities, is it?
I think this is a sector that is often quite good at responding to incentives. And the incentives don't have to be, you know, we will fully fund the thing. It is often a bit, you know, it's a combination of saying, well, this is the direction of travel of the policy environment, and this is the way that we're structuring the bits of money that are available. And then the sector has the opportunity to say, well, okay, is this actually going to be, you know, is this sufficiently meaningful for us to engage with and change what we're already doing? And I suspect, you know, different institutions will have different views about, we'll have different views about that. I think it's interesting that the capital funding is, the direction is to allocate as much of it as possible on a competitive basis. So, you know, there will be, we also know from the OFS financial sustainability letter the other week that there's quite a lot of capital investment being deferred. But, you know, this isn't the only source of funding for capital. It remains possible to bring in private loans and all the rest of it. So I think that the long term, the idea that DfE kind of issues cap. I mean, I think one of the things DfE should probably think about is say, can we, rather than saying this is available to the whole sector, say actually which are the institutions that need to be able to draw down public capital funding or would need that as a way to kind of to offset their kind of perhaps more risky in the private market and less able to realise their own investments in that way. That would probably be a better way to think about it than just sort of saying, oh, well, can we just invest in stuff that, you know, the government thinks is important, depending, you know, at different parts of the country, and is quite sort of agnostic about whether those institutions could actually just invest it, you know, could raise the funds themselves to make those investments if that was kind of what they wanted to do strategically.
I guess there's a question here about who the letter's really for, though, and, you know, who reads it, who promotes the outcomes from it, and what else is going on in the background. Because I think all the topics on this that we're discussing this morning, that's a whole policy environment, and we're going to be talking about graduate employment later. So there's that link between why do people go to university, what do they expect to do afterwards, and I think that's in scope. But I also think this is kind of playing to the gallery here with the way the media is going to report it in terms of other things that may have to go on in terms of shoring up the sector. So I think maintaining the appearance and the actuality of keeping a really tight grip on sector finances with the one hand, while potentially having to shore up the sector in deals that may be going on behind the scenes, is, you know, in parallel. So I think there's a bigger picture, and the letter is actually only one small part of it.
But just looking ahead to sort of June, in theory, June, Sean, you know, the original design of this system was everyone can charge up to £9,000, and we'll incentivize types of provision in parts of the country, some of which is more expensive to put on than others, through additional funding. Now, if we have effectively moved out of incentivizing, what does the government do next in order to influence what gets put on, who it's put on for, and where it's put on. You know, what can it do? Will there be a levy on home student, on domestic student fees? Is it student number controls? Because presumably, on one level or another, this is a government that wants to influence what and where and who.
It does look to me like we're creeping towards student number controls, because I can't see how we manage regional decline without it. And I would be really worried about regional collapse of higher education. So I personally would be looking at number controls to support that, to support the distribution and access to HE right across the country.
That's right, in the sense of if the lever for funding high cost and subjects that are linked to the industrial strategy cannot get bigger because of the fiscal context and what other government priorities there are, then inevitably you have to use other tools at your disposal, and the regulatory and the number control tools are probably what the government has got to link it to the industrial strategy, and obviously linked to place, which we're going to obviously talking about in a moment. So I think that may be an inevitability over the next few years that we do move in that direction.
Now, Debbie, there's one of the cuts in there that made me fall off my chair was about mobility. Just explain this for us.
Right. Yeah. So one of the things that has been removed is support for outward and inward mobility schemes. So we're thinking about the funding that universities can use to support students to participate in things like the touring scheme, which was introduced as the alternative to Erasmus Plus when we left the European Union. Now, This is happening on the same day as the Prime Minister is saying, I've secured a deal with the EU, one of the elements of which, of course, we knew one of the sticking points was around youth mobility. And one of the outcomes of which was a commitment from the UK to work towards Erasmus Plus participation over time. So yeah, there's an element here of, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
Well, I mean, Sean, I think one of the things that's interesting is if we were back in Erasmus Plus, it's not just about mobility. There's all sorts of kind of infrastructure level projects about teaching improvement and skills and digital transformation and so on. If we were back in Erasmus Plus today, there would be more sector infrastructure being funded via that we pay into the EU and get some stuff back out of the EU than we get from the DfE.
It feels like we've reached the end of what market forces can do for HE, and it feels like the government hasn't got to grips with the implications of that, or doesn't like the implications of it.
But whether or not there's an alternative, I guess we'll find out in June. So, well, fascinating stuff.
The point, though, on that, Jim, is what's interesting is, I don't know what your experience, Shan, at Middlesex is and other institutions you've been a leader of, but often it's the Anglophone countries which are the most popular for UK students to study abroad. It's the US, it's Canada, it's Australia. And is the government, through these decisions, suggesting actually they're prioritising engagement and mobility to Europe rather than Commonwealth nations and countries? And there's an interesting distinction there, and I think it's one that we should reflect on.
Do you think is it that deep there, Richard? Is it that deep, as they say, as a younger colleague said? Because I think the EU wants youth mobility because that's something that is kind of valued. It's in the fabric of the project, right? And so we're negotiating over 1,000 other things to try and kind of move the markets in that direction. So if youth mobility is part of that picture, then I guess we'll engage on that topic, right? I mean, I'm not sure there's a question of sort of saying, oh, but what about the common, I think that's just been sort of swept up in a bigger issue, and that's all, and that's all good, really.
I'm not suggesting it's conscious, it might be more subconscious, but there is obviously a desire amongst, and the sector itself has obviously made a big call around Erasmus too, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, but as Jim mentioned at the start, they are, giving one hand and taking from the other, and it doesn't seem very holistic.
The other thing that strikes me about studying in Europe these days is that, say, in comparison to 10 years ago, pretty much every European university has now got a significant portfolio of English language delivered programs, partly because it is trying to attract international students. And, that's the kind of global universal language. In comparison to 10 years ago, I just, the amount of choice available now across Europe has just, exponentially grown. So, I wonder whether the commentary, which is very few students will take it up, and if they do, they would prefer to be in you know, North America or the Anglophone countries. I wonder whether that would be true once we're back in, which apparently won't be for 5 years anyway.
I think European higher education might be kind of, you know, the best kept secret in the world. If you've ever spent a little bit of time in one of the kind of Netherlands universities, for example, and you know, it's just like it's delightfully sunny. The courses are in English. You're in a lovely little university town. I mean, I will strongly be advising my kids to, yeah, well, exactly, you know, and you know, and all the things that you've been pointing out, Jim, regularly about sort of all the various clever things that they do in Europe to kind of make the money go further. I would certainly, I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, you must look to Europe, but I would certainly think that any young person who had the option and who could afford it to factor that into their decision making.
Well, fascinating stuff. Plenty on the site about all of that, including some of my antics in Europe last week. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Nick Whitten.
And I'm Alex Mosley.
And this week on Wonky, we've been blogging about the benefits of playful leadership.
Now, playful leadership might seem a bit inappropriate when the whole sector is in a bit of a mess right now. But bear with us. We're not suggesting that vice-chancellors start playing games or that staff start wearing silly hats.
What we suggest is that some of the values and behaviours that underpin play philosophy could be useful for university leadership navigating change and uncertainty. In particular, we highlight the importance of being open, being brave, and being vulnerable.
We argue that leaders who are open, embracing new ideas, and not being afraid to do things differently will have an edge in a sector. Importantly, leaders need to be open to scrutiny in their decision-making and able to make mistakes, own them, and learn from those mistakes.
We've given some examples of great leadership currently in the sector where these values are already being embraced with positive effect.
And we hope that this piece will show that play has the potential to make a positive impact in all aspects of higher education, as long as we open our eyes to the value of play and we're not afraid to make a few mistakes along the way.
Now, next up, we've had the long-awaited independent review of student suicides published this week. Richard, what did it find?
Yeah, so thanks, Jim. Yeah, so this week DfE published its review into students with suicides, and obviously the review was launched by Robert Halfen in 2023, following a campaign by bereaved families for a statutory duty of care to all students to be implemented. And a really quite significant debate in Westminster Hall. So now the review has found that most of the cases were undergraduates with first years and international students particularly vulnerable. Really plays to the piece around how transition to and through higher education, of course, is so important. It found that 3/4 of cases that families were not included in the review following a death, and that many of the students were known to have to their universities to be struggling from mental health. The review suggests that we holistic sort of staff a student suicide awareness training, that much better information sharing across institutions, that there are lots of silos, a review of accommodation safety, and better transparency with families. Been welcomed, I think, by many people in the sector, but it's also been challenged by the Eberhardt family who led the campaign, who felt that this review sort of doesn't say anything which we didn't already know.
Well, yes, I mean, it's certainly, you know, pretty sobering reading. I, you know, went through it in some detail on Wednesday. Now, Sean, well, you know, this let's deal with this thing about the involvement of bereaved families following a suicide. What's going on there? Are there particular reasons that you're aware of that universities are nervous about involving families? Because it obviously seems to me to be, certainly from the report, it feels like something that ought to happen.
So it's heartbreaking when we lose a student, whether by suicide or by any other death, and the whole university community does feel it. And I've spoken to bereaved families, and it's hugely painful. It's painful on my side, and I can't imagine the pain on their side. So I've been involved in situations like this, and I think personally, it takes quite a lot of courage to enact what I think we could all agree on, which is the need for candor. You know, I don't think there's any... I looked at the recommendations and improved training, share information, better review and improve accommodation for vulnerable students, and then open, transparent and proactive in communicating with families after a suspected suicide. I think they're all... we absolutely should be doing all of those things. So I think what happens is sometimes it's difficult. It's difficult for the university, for the people. And then sometimes there's a bit of being joined up as a university. So I think, and I was thinking about the Eberhardt families feeling it didn't go far enough, and it wasn't strong enough. It wasn't legislatively strong enough. But I think it is, I think what we need is a real will to join up communication, to have somebody who's front facing and somebody with the right skills to talk to bereaved families. And I actually think as a sector, we do need to try harder to do that consistently. So I have no problem at all with the recommendations. I think we should be taking them forward.
Yes, obviously on this, certainly on the duty of candour, of course, we're over a month past Keir Starmer's original deadline for announcing a legislative duty of candour. But interestingly, of course, the rumours are that there is disagreement about whether or not that duty of candour on public authorities should apply only to external inquiries, you know, formal public inquiries, or to internal processes of this sort. So doubtless in the next few weeks, there will have to be some sort of update from the government, presumably before we get to recess. More broadly, Debbie, you know, one of the things that comes through, you know, really clearly here, but actually also really clearly in reports that aren't about suicide, that are maybe more generally about mental health, is this thing about the join up between academic staff and student services staff. And it just feels like something that can't, you know, is impossible to fix.
Yes, because I think you are talking about often, I mean, let's take it as our starting point that, you know, you've got an awful lot of different kinds of students and an awful lot of different kinds of institutions. And, you know, and I think one of the things that, if, you know, people who work in small institutions will say, actually, we don't really have that problem because, you know, we see them, you know, we know who they are. And actually, we don't have these kind of vast, you know, infrastructures that then require kind of process. I think, you know, it's really hard to know, isn't it? It is to some extent all but inevitable that if you've got one part of the institution delivering one part of the offer and another part of the institution delivering another part of it, and one of the kind of presumptions is that, you know, if you have a very good electronic system which you are supposedly kind of recording information, but ultimately it's fundamentally kind of handed to the student to try and kind of, you know, sort of navigate between those poles, that there will be slippage, I think. At the same time, you know, that's I'm not sure that that's something that we would wish to accept. And I know that lots of institutions work very hard to try and avoid that happening. And I think there's a question to me about kind of organizational structure and how these things, and I mean, there's some really good examples, I think, of where people have tried to find ways around that challenge, because I think it is a structural one.
Yeah, sorry. I absolutely agree with Debbie. I think it's systemic, and it's because there's two bits of legislation as well, which appear to conflict, and you really have to navigate that, which is about confidentiality and data protection. So the point at which data can be shared is sometimes not quite clear, and people are really worried about breaching one piece of legislation, you know, to a good end. And I know when we're looking at systems, who's got access to information is quite hard to determine, to make sure only the person who needs the information and will use the information can get it. So that can be addressed at a systemic level, but it's actually quite difficult. So I think that's work in progress. So I think it is absolutely about being joined up and systemic. I was also struck that when Debbie mentioned about, you know, smaller institutions, it may not apply at all in the same way, because actually people are just talking to each other and they know each other much better. But I was actually struck by the absence of pattern and the ability to predict who is most at risk in the report. So although there were groups that were more at risk, it wasn't definitive enough that you could predict. And there were clearly lots, you know, there were so many different reasons why a student might be at risk or there might be risk of harm. And I'm really struck by overall that sense that your community has to care for each other, and you have to be able to look out for students, and you have to be able to spot signs of risk very early, and they may come up in lots of different ways and they may not all be flagged in the same system. So I think you both need that kind of systemic joined up data, knowing how the data flows through, knowing that you're legally entitled to pass data on, but also that you've got the right people in place who are responding and passing information through when they notice there's a change in a student's behaviour. So I think you need both. And I think it needs to be really joined up and really thought through and really owned in an institution.
You know, the point that you made there, Sian, about the community is so important in terms of, you know, the relational approach that needs to be made. within institutions to tackle these issues and around prevention. And this isn't obviously a point about higher education. This is a point across sort of the public and private realm in the UK that we've moved too far away from that. But unfortunately, that is expensive because it requires human beings and not data and processes, right? And you know, it's a rather obvious point. And I think this isn't a point about the HE, but sometimes we lose sight of that. And I do think, you know, we're talking about the previous point around funding, Jim. There are, you know, you can make big changes with relatively small amounts of money on the right innovations in this space. And I do think there is a role for government in here about thinking about a sector-wide approach on, you know, for example, you know, a good example of this is that recently it was announced that the Nightline Association is folding because they haven't got enough support. Now, could through government funding, not necessarily the Nightline Association, but should there be a sector-wide approach to peer-to-peer student engagement that is supported by you know, 10 million quid from the government? You know, we've just been talking about there being an £83 million capital pot, you know, is that going to touch the site as well? 10, 15 million quid on something like this that is relational peer-to-peer could make a massive difference to people's lives.
I agree. This is where I'd go for a carrot and not a stick, because I think legislation would be so hard to like, even the point the report makes, I think, about legislation, about training. It's really hard to know who should be having it, who the right person is, what's the right amount, what regularity, when do new staff get it? You know, if you start legislating for that, it's a nightmare. So that's where I put the carrot in. And that is absolutely where I think there should be government funding.
That's interesting, because something that struck me as well was, you know, going through Jim's piece and thinking, okay, right, let's just, you know, run the numbers on how would you design something, you know, what would this duty of care look like? And it struck me, and I know, I mean, I completely take your point, Sian, about saying this is not a predictable, this is not that you can just say this is always about, you know, young people transitioning into particular kinds of higher education environments. But it does strike me that if you were to kind of risk assess what you know, one of the kind of cases against a universal duty of care is that students are incredibly diverse and they engage with higher education in incredibly diverse ways. And it seems to me that the duty of care is just significantly less if you're talking about a mature postgraduate who is part-time and who is employed, for example, than if you are talking about an 18-year-old who's moved halfway across the country into a highly, highly selective academic environment, who's already got, you know, who might perhaps already have a history of mental health challenges. You know, this is the balance of risk in these cases is going to be very, very different. And the balance of responsibility, I think, is also going to be very, very different. So something that was a sort of catch-all thing, it would have to be so light as to be almost to be potentially quite meaningless. But I think there might be something about saying, actually, institutions need to be doing a bit more of that risk assessment, and where there is opportunity and having those, that kind of architecture in place, and actually that assumption that each individual institution is doing it each individually for themselves, when actually we're talking about something that is a kind of universal challenge. That's another reason why a sort of regulatory way into this might not necessarily be the best one.
But let me ask you this question, Sian. So you know, in England, institutions on August the 1st become subject to a piece of regulation that pretty much requires there to be training for all student-facing staff on harassment and sexual misconduct. And, you know, it's fairly well defined in the OFS, you know, in the OFS guidance. There's some flexibility depending on, you know, nature and size of provider, and also advice to flex it depending on the nature of your students and so on. How on earth have we ended up in a situation where we're regulating staff training on harassment and sexual misconduct, but not on, you know, the basics around mental health? Partly because, you know, one of the threads in this research is around neurodiversity. And, you know, it just feels like it ought to be, given the huge volume of neurodiverse students that are knocking around now, feels like that ought to be in the same basket to me.
Yeah, I think, for me, it's not because we shouldn't be training. I can, you know, absolutely agree with that. I think it's that once you bring the legislation in, you've got a stick to punish institutions if something goes wrong, and then you can show they didn't do the training. So I think what I'd like is that positive culture rather than negative culture. You know, I'd like us to be doing the training because we're all very clear about what outcome we want, which is better support for students, students at risk being identified earlier, rather than the kind of punishment element, because that's where the legislation really kicks in, isn't it? They're not going to check that we've trained everybody. What they're going to do is find out if something goes wrong.
But is that how it feels, and is that how it's panning out over harassment and sexual misconduct? Is everyone viewing that duty as negative?
No, I don't see it as negative. I see it as culture change. I see it as absolutely necessary culture change.
Well, in that case, it sounds like the legislation would be fine.
Well, I mean, you can absolutely make a case that this harassment and sexual misconduct shouldn't be regulated on. And I think particularly in the context of, you know, the kind of mission creep of OFS and all the rest of it. But that's always quite a hard case to make, obviously, when you're talking about people's lives, about distressing experiences, you know, and topics like death by suicide. Because I think, you know, when you go in from that lens of having had that experience or having had that event, you look backwards. And of course, you can find all the different things that perhaps in the best of all worlds ought to have been the case.
Debbie, let me ask you this question, right? So, you know, obviously we published the student health stuff the other week. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in the free text comments, one of the things we asked students was, what would make you feel healthier? And there's a really strong thread in there, actually, of students, interestingly, particularly in STEM subjects, who were saying that they felt their academic environment wasn't very healthy. And that was partly about, you know, a refusal to talk about or even think about mental health, you know, not being very sympathetic with long-term health conditions, over-assessment, presenteeism, and so on. Now, you know, just this week, I was talking to someone who said they'd had a conversation with a dean of a faculty who said, we're not doing mental health in here. And it's like, that's not viable, is it?
Okay, do you know what? Because it is really hard, I think, in these conversations, because you're sort of pivoting between a kind of legalistic kind of framework and a human framework. And, you know, and if you end up on kind of with these sort of weird polarized kind of thing. And I think the question to my mind is, what is the standard? How would we articulate a standard that requires an approach? You know, I don't think, you know, mandating training and saying you've got to have a system to share information is the right approach, because it's going to be different for each individual institution. But I think it might be fine to say you've got to evidence that you're giving attention to these topics. So I don't, you know, I think it's not about saying should we regulate or should we not. It's about saying, what does a version of regulation look like that enables, that is enabling institutions to put their resources where it's going to make the most difference?
And I guess, you know, we've certainly discussed before, haven't we, the character in England of regulation feeling very punitive rather than enabling. And perhaps that's, you know, one of the reasons why people are very worried about it. Richard, go on.
Sorry, the issue about mandating training is not the mandate, you know, it's not mandating the training, it's what happens afterwards. And it's the quality that really matters, the quality of that training. And the challenge that you always have is, if you make something mandatory, is does it then move into sort of a lowest common denominator and a tick box exercise for various parts of universities in the sector? So if you are going to, you know, enforce more standards or regulation in training, you've also got to look at the quality of it and how people are doing it, and whether it's actually having an impact, because otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah, you could bake this stuff. If you think about the Wales, the MEDR approach to regulation, they've got the quality framework, they've got the kind of bit about attention to staff and student wellbeing. You could say this is a question about student success and the creation of a learning environment in which all can flourish. You could say, right, then let's look at the ways that higher education providers are taking a continuous enhancement approach to supporting wellbeing as part of their academic endeavour. And you could sort of, you know, you could sort of weave it in, and you could bake in things like, you know, harassment and that sort of thing as well, rather than having these kind of individual strands of things whenever the train shall meet, and it becomes layered and layered and layered and completely overwhelming for institutions.
Yeah. I agree. What I'd like to see is a focus on institutions learning and owning this. So I think the postvention process is really important, and that's the bit I think I'd be legislating for. I'd want to see that people had evidence that they'd reviewed situations. They'd done a risk analysis and they'd put in place learning from it. And that would be the bit I'd be much more comfortable legislating for that, because I think it's driving culture change and it's driving local agency and something that's appropriate to your institution. And I think you could legislate for that, just like you do in other health and safety risk situations. You'd ask to see a near misses register.
Yes, I have a blog on this on the site, actually, from a couple of years ago. But actually, interestingly, Sean, one of the things I was going to ask you about was, one of the things that did strike me was the stuff in there about international students. And I guess that, you know, if you took this piece of evidence and you were doing that kind of classic risk assessment approach where you identify a group of people or an issue and then the risk mitigation steps you could take, you know, it seems really obvious in a way that international students are much more likely to be at risk here for all sorts of the reasons that are identified. But it also feels like there aren't many institutions that have, you know, a line on in the table in the risk assessment that says, well, here are the specific extra steps we're going to take in terms of mental health.
I agree. I think absolutely international students, you would expect to be a group that's at higher risk because they've stepped away from their culture. They've maybe stepped away from their family. We know that some international students come here because they've got family here, but they may be stepping away from lots of their normal support network, and things are very unfamiliar and there's high stress because their families may be, you know, investing heavily in their education here. Oh, absolutely, I agree, those are risk factors, and I think we do need to get better as institutions at seeing those risk factors and putting in place more layers of support.
Richard, just before we finish here, you know, the government obviously has, you know, re-rejected a formal duty of care, but it's also, I mean, the tone of it is very universities must fix this. And, you know, notwithstanding the usual complaint that I have, which is this is being owned and launched by and talked about by DfE rather than, you know, by the Department for Health or the Health Minister, you know, loading all of this in terms of responsibility onto universities, notwithstanding the really important recommendations for universities in the report, just doesn't feel right, does it?
Well, there's clearly specific things that as a sector we need to improve upon, which the report sort of articulates. I think where we're all trying to get to grips with is that there's major, you know, societal change happening for a variety of different reasons. And what is, you know, the cause of some of these challenges, but also what are the expectations on institutions? And I think that's where, you know, I think there's some really important findings in this review, but it's not, none of this is going to be particularly surprising for people that have sort of been thinking about this issue for a few years. And so what I think would be really welcome is a sort of a longer term look from government and others around how that sort of societal changes are shifting, whether it's the use of technology, whether it's, you know, relationships with people, and what is the role of institutions in navigating through those social challenges.
Now, we've launched something quite exciting this week. Here's Mark to tell us more.
Hello, it's Mark here, and I just wanted to drop in and tell you about a new venture we launched this week as we continue to expand the Wonky Cinematic Universe over the course of 2025. It's called the Post 18 Project. We think there's an opportunity to fill in some of the gaps between post 18 education and the government, particularly the Labour government in Westminster right now. So we want to offer practical policy solutions and ideas to help do just that, and have a big conversation about the future of post 18 education in the UK, all in a longer and deeper format than we can do on a day-to-day basis on Wonky. Our three areas of interest for the year ahead are higher education for the common good, reimagining post-18 education, and universities and colleges in a changing world. Each theme has some really interesting work going on underneath it, and you'll be seeing more of that in the coming weeks and months. We're supported by a brilliant advisory board from across higher and further education, skills, business, and policymaking. We hope you join us on this journey as the Post-18 Project takes flight.
Now, finally this week, we've had a raft of interesting research looking at access and opportunity, with Place featuring quite prominently. Sean, what's been published?
Richard, in fact, UPP Foundation Inquiry 2025 has published a report on cold spots and calculated risk, understanding attitudes to higher education in Doncaster. And there's lots to like about this report. One of the things I really like was the specificity, actually, of taking a place like Doncaster and then hearing the voices of local people coming through. So the overwhelmingly, the argument here is that people are making rational decisions not to access higher education if higher education doesn't offer them a life that they want, because if they want to live in the place they call home and there isn't graduate work there, then it is not irrational to choose not to go into HE. And that this, you know, we've also talked already in the programme about the problems of cold spots in HE and people who want to access HE not being able to do it locally. So there's a lot of dimensions to this. One is, can you access HE locally? Another is, do you leave your local area to go into HE? Therefore, you know, young people and graduates leaving that area. So a drain of youth and education and economic potential from different areas. And also then that question about where is their graduate employment? And the overall increase in wealth division, exacerbated divisions between wealth and poverty. It's sort of been driving that cycle. But the UPP Foundation report is particularly about the emotional cost of leaving the place you call home to go and live somewhere else when you don't really want to do that if you're pursuing, in order to pursue graduate opportunities. But this was me as well. I left Swansea for university at 18. And didn't go back to Swansea. And my first full-time job was in London. And I never lived in Swansea again after I was 18. So absolutely, it's clear it's not irrational on the part of young people and families not to choose university if you want to live where you call home. But that's still a bad outcome for young people's opportunities and for mature students in those areas who want new opportunities or want to retrain, and for economic parity across regions. And divisiveness in politics and economics seems to me at the root of so many problems we've got now globally, that I think anything that drives up divisiveness is problematic. And this is absolutely where we need a government policy approach to access to higher education and graduate employment opportunities. And we need a joined up policy for this, because that divisiveness will drive consequences that we can see around the world that are absolutely toxic.
Richard, credit where it's due. This is a terrific bit of work. And one of the things that was kind of going through my mind when I was reading it was a year I spent when I worked at UEA in Norwich, basically living in Great Yarmouth at night, because I couldn't commute back to Watford every day. And I was, you know, in kind of Spoons and you know, some of the other pubs and so on. I eventually started to get to know some of them. And the overwhelming message they gave me was, why would we want our kids to leave us and never come back? We want to be invested in, not for our kids to be invested in if they leave us. It was really hard to argue with that.
Sort of my favourite bits of working for the foundation and doing some of these pieces of work is actually observing these qualitative, you know, the focus groups, because you really get to sort of grips with what's going on in different parts of the country. And, I really recommend any, you know, university leader sort of actually sort of engaging in this, because I think it will really sort of underlines the sort of perception that people have around higher education up and down the country. So to give you a bit of context, this is the sort of second report that we're publishing as part of a sort of quick inquiry into widening participation. It's a real focus on cold spots. So we went to Doncaster and did a two-day immersive research in Doncaster. The reason why we chose Doncaster was because we thought that it doesn't have any particular unique characteristics unlike some other cold spots. We think there are some general lessons that can be drawn for other parts of the country on this. We did 60 odd interviews in 2 days in and around Doncaster, and two focus groups, one for a 18 year old cohort and one for a parent cohort. And so what really came through, as we say in the report, is the bet for going to university for people in Doncaster, for lots of people, is too risky. Unless you're a very high attaining student in Doncaster, the risk is really high based on two factors. A, cost. So the cost of living for students, as well as the debt, which they're, you know, very concerned about. But link that with what opportunities there are in and around Doncaster for graduate jobs, and that, you know, that there aren't, and they feel that the risk of going to university is higher than not going. And as Sian has mentioned, those sort of family ties are really, really important. Community, sense of belonging, being close to your family and friends. Sadly, there was real, you know, for the people that we've interviewed, there was a real sense of disappointment in their own personal educational journeys in terms of, you know, the schools, the FE college, and the advice and guidance that got from universities in the region. And it sort of has led to a multi-generational and multifaceted view that the higher education basically isn't for them. And there was a real sort of, I don't think I can emphasize this enough, a real view of sort of short-termism around education, around it has to be around the next or the first job. What is the salary going to be for my first job? There wasn't really a view around how education is going to set me up for life. It was about, you know, what is it going to lead to next? Which I found, you know, was really interesting and fascinating. But there are some, you know, real challenges there for us all to get to grips with. And obviously, we're going to be looking at putting together a recommendations report in July as we conclude this. But yeah, hopefully, it's a fascinating piece of work that will inform the sector.
You end up talking about kind of, there's a lot of clustering, isn't there, in the end, Debbie, where, you know, I mean, the Sutton Trust data, you know, 42 of the top 50 opportunity constituencies are in London. Now, you know, that just becomes inevitable, doesn't it? Or does it?
Well, yeah, but if you've got the kind of clustering of jobs and industries and employers and universities and, you know, in cities, I think, yeah, that there is a degree of inevitability about that. I suppose the question then is, if that happens organically to some extent, then what do you then do with the places that haven't experienced that clustering effect? You don't want the whole country to kind of look like a city. Is this more about offering a different way of accessing higher education, something more flexible, something more kind of drip fed, but some you know, perhaps something online? Is this about investing in jobs that or kind of trying to develop the industries that are then going to be offering the graduate jobs, prompting people to say, well, actually, no, I do need to get the education to do that? I think looking at it, I think one of the things that universities are probably going to have to get used to is not looking at the idea of opportunity through the lens solely of going to university, if that makes sense. So if you think about opportunity as being about, what's my place like to live in? What are literally the opportunities available to me to take part in society, to be employed in a job that feels worthwhile? And then thinking about education and where education, you know, sits in that ecosystem. And the extent to which universities are able to kind of position themselves in that ecosystem, which is probably going to include, and this, of course, is why one of the reasons we've launched the Post 18 project, other kinds of education that might be provided by universities, but might be provided by, you know, by other sorts of provider as well, might be, you know, and might incorporate work in interesting and different ways, the more that you're going to get better solutions, I think.
I'll tell you what I was thinking, though, Sean, when I was reading it, you know, it's not as if Doncaster doesn't have any higher education, right? You know, University Campus Doncaster is, you know, part of the DN Colleges group. It's providing a range of higher level technical programs. We are stuck, aren't we, given what happened in 1992, with, to some extent, a perception of higher education that is, you know, fiddling around for a few years, doing, you know, going and finding yourself. Whereas, you know, clearly there's a whole bunch of, you know, arguably, you know, much closer to that sort of stuff that Richard was talking about in terms of leading to a career provision that perhaps, you know, perhaps people are not recognizing as university or even higher education, despite the fact those courses are on and appear to be thriving.
What I really took out of the report was the difference between an individual making a rational decision for them and what we want as a good for society, which has to be driven at a policy level. Because I believe that more graduates leads to more graduate employment, because you get businesses and startup and industries and partnerships and international working, so that a more educated population leads to economic growth at a high level. And as I said, I really think that we need all regions to be part of that and to feel they're bought into it and they're invested in it, and there are opportunities for people to get graduate jobs wherever they are in the country. But that is that can't be done by individuals. That has to be done at a policy level. I was also struck by the importance of education being where people are. So back to the earlier point about changes in funding potentially impacting HE and FE, because if you've got regions that are code spots, having schools and colleges network with opportunities to keep moving through the system into HE when you want to. So there is more of a clearly lifelong learning and pathways for people that are clearly relevant to them and what they're doing at the moment, and allow them to see a future. Again, so that's all joined up. So this isn't about what an individual can choose, because people will make choices in their own interests based on what they can see in front of them. It is about having a joined up policy that allows these pathways to lead to employment and anywhere in the country.
I think what I would say, Jim, is I really enjoyed reading the Sutton Trust report, the Opportunity Index as well. And I do think it's important to sort of highlight how different London is almost to any other part of the country for a variety of different reasons. And I've experienced that as a, you know, setting up and running the UPP Foundation. As an anecdote, when we, and I often say this, but when we sort of had calls for grants and you have charities coming to us for pots of funding, particularly around sort of access to HE in some form, often you'll get sort of quite entrepreneurial people that have gone through something like Teach First, and they've set up a small charity in Islington or Tower Hamlets or Tottenham. And then as it expands, it goes to the West Midlands. And what I think is underexplored, you know, there's some great charities like Into and others, but what is underexplored is the sort of third sector support that people in poorer parts of London get in comparison to other parts of the country too. I think there's layers and layers of advantage because of the nature of London, which other parts of the country don't get. And you know, I don't have a solution of how you change that and fix that, but it's something that we need to be aware of, and there sort of needs to be that sort of real focus on how we can ensure those pathways are effective in all parts of the country.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Sian, Richard, Debbie, Michael, Salmon for making it all happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.